Three.
What are you doing?
Getting ready for another long pledge drive. They're like marathons, so you gotta train for them.
Actually, this time around, it's more like a sprint, starting with WILL's second power hour, March 29th at 7 a.m. People can also contribute early by calling 217-244-9455 or going online at willpledge.org. You can take off the leg warmers now.
Can I still keep my Focus 580 sweatbands?
The Power Hour, 7 a.m., March 29th.
Support for today's broadcast is provided by World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 15 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of name-brand foods from around the world. Your suggestions and requests are always welcome. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. The gross domestic product is a measurement of the output of goods and services produced in the U.S., but the GDP does not account for all goods and services produced in this country. And on the program today, we're going to take a look at the underground economy of one neighborhood on the south side of Chicago. Our guest is Columbia University sociologist Sudhir Aladi Venkatesh. He is the author of Off the Books, The Underground Economy of the Urban Poor. He was a graduate student at the University of Chicago in the 1990s, and while he was there studying public housing, he became fascinated with the underground economy. In the prologue to Off the Books, Professor Venkatesh says he discovered, quoting here, that the seemingly random collection of men and women in the community, young and old, professional and destitute, were nearly all linked together in a vast, often invisible web that girded their neighborhood. And that web, says Professor Venkatesh, is the underground economy. Sudhir Aladi Venkatesh is professor of sociology and director of research at the Institute for Research in African American Studies at Columbia University. Off the Books, The Underground Economy of the Urban Poor is published by Harvard University Press. Professor Venkatesh, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Would you describe the neighborhood that is the subject of this book and give us a bit of its history?
Sure. The neighborhood is called McKee Park. I use that name because it's a fictitious name just to protect the identity of some of the people who participated in the study. But it's in the broad section of Chicago, which is the South Side, which historically was called the Black Metropolis or Bronzeville. And it was one of the two primary areas of settlement for African Americans who came from the South as part of the Great Migration to the North in the mid-20th century, early and mid-20th century. It's a very historic area, an area of, you know, it could have empty lots, it could have brownstones. It's a mix of the poor and middle class and working class living together. But today it is really a space of concentrated poverty. It has nearly 40-45% of the people receiving welfare, almost a similar number out of the labor force. It's an area that has really declined in terms of its socioeconomic status over the past, I'd say, 30 years.
It's really interesting to see the variety of people who are part of the underground economy here and the variety of transactions that take place in this economy. Would you give us some examples of some of the people involved and what they're trading?
Sure. Most of the time you hear about the underground economy and it conjures up these notions of the criminal side of it. But in a poor neighborhood, it can range from people who are selling food out of their home or making clothes and selling it, to people who are offering tax preparation off the books, to the criminal side, which could include things like selling stolen car parts or narcotics trafficking, drug dealing, selling guns and ammunition. the range of people are really not only the down and out, but even a store owner, a person who owns a dollar store or owns a convenience store who otherwise, for example, couldn't afford to hire a security guard and pay union wages. That person will go ahead and hire a homeless person or a person who lives on the streets or has a very transient existence to sleep in their facility overnight, paying them maybe $10 or $20 off the books, under the table, and in turn they'll get somebody to watch over their store at night. And it's in that sense that peculiar and sometimes unpredictable relationships can form between people in the legitimate economy and in the underground economy. And that's what the book tries to draw out, the kind of unexpected ways in which different people get brought into this process. And the one other group of people I should point out are folks who solve the problems that come with the underground economy.
Mm-hmm.
So people like the clergy or a block club president, you know, a block club president who sees that the street gang is dealing drugs on the street corner, they'll have to go out there if they can't get the police to do so to make sure that the street gang does not stay there when children are playing. You know, a funny compromise might be met with the gang leader.
Very interesting. Negotiations have to go on all the time. And because, as you mentioned, you might not be able to rely on the police. Often you can't rely on the police. You might be part of this underground economy. Also, you know, the Better Business Bureau isn't going to be in the neighborhood either. And also, it seems that you mentioned some of the people involved and what they're working at and what they're trading and what's involved in it. On the surface of it, might not be so obvious, but then when you start to pay attention, you can see all kinds of different relationships. And you mentioned the business that might hire somebody to sleep inside overnight to provide some kind of protection. But also there are people outside the neighborhood who are participating, who might be participating, taking advantage of the underground economy. There are women, for example, who work as maids or nannies for middle-class families.
That's right. That's right. So it's not completely confined to the local neighborhood. Many of the pastors in this neighborhood are catering to congregations that commute from other parts of the city, and so they will find for those people that come into their church local residents who can clean homes or take care of children. And vice versa, a lot of folks from the neighboring communities that are more middle class or upper class in Chicago, like Hyde Park, which is also in the South Side where the University of Chicago is based, those folks might come into the poorer areas to draw on the underground economy, sometimes getting their car fixed, sometimes buying drugs or soliciting local prostitution, but often just to buy some cheap goods that are being sold in the park. So there's a lot of crossover in terms of the neighborhoods of Chicago depending on one another through the underground economy.
Mm. Tell us more about the role clergymen play as brokers.
This is probably the most surprising element for me because when we think about the economy, any economy, we usually think about the good that's being transacted. But the other part of it is that if something goes wrong, and invariably something does go wrong, we have to have recourse. I can, in the legitimate economy, I can call the police or go to small claims court. For those folks, they need a third-party arbiter or a broker. And often the clergy, because they have moral weight and moral standing, can play that role. In the poorest of communities, it's the storefront pastors, the grassroots clergy, the folks who operate maybe out of their living room or out of a very small building, that have to stay in the neighborhood and respond to the needs of the people. And so they end up solving all sorts of problems, from pricing disputes. You know, I fixed your car and you said, one person says 30, the other person thought they heard 20, to even to much more complicated problems like street gang wars. And it puts the clergy in a very difficult position because, on the one hand, they're trying to make sure that the neighborhood doesn't have to rely on these sorts of desperate mechanisms to survive, yet they have to make sure that the neighborhood is also safe. And so attending to those two obligations can be a very difficult duty for them over the long term.
Yeah. You say in the book that seeing the underground economy had a great impact on your work with gangs, and there are very interesting relationships in the community between the people who are outside the gang and the gang.
Yeah, and I should say that for the last 30 or 40 years, our understanding of street gang activity via criminology and sociology has largely been that they're an enemy within the neighborhood. That I was taught that many students are taught that the street gang is loathed by the residents, that all the residents would like to get rid of them. in some sense, what the residents would like to get rid of is the crime and the instability associated with the street gang. But that street gang member is also their son or their nephew or someone that they've grown up with, that they've seen play basketball on the school basketball team. And then that person makes a set of choices that get them into this line of work or this line of activity on the streets. And so, you know, again, just turning to a block club president, for example, they have to simultaneously deal with their nephew, who also happens to be a street gang leader. And they have to deal with them in the context of not being always able to rely on the police. So there are these peculiar and, again, unpredictable relationships that result because you're trying to, on the one hand, keep your neighborhood safe, and so you're going to use your connections to the street gang. On the other hand, you really don't necessarily want the street gang there. You know, if they lived in a perfect world in which they had police who responded quickly, they probably would let the police do their job. But when they don't, they have to police themselves, and it's the part, it's that part of the underground economy in poor neighborhoods, having to police oneself, that raises all of these very difficult issues for poor families.
Yeah, and there are pressures on the gangs as well. You tell the story in the book of a handful of people that had to come together to negotiate about a park. The gang, the Black Kings, the gang that you call the Black Kings, they want to expand their business. They got to keep making money. So Big Cat, the leader of this gang, sees this park as a great canvas for doing business. And the people in the community, though, they say, wait a minute, that's our park. That's for our kids. You know, that should be a safe place. Tell us about the negotiations that went on between a woman named Marlene, Big Cat, and this pastor, Pastor Wilkins.
Mm-hmm. Marlene is the block club president of this one block on Maryland Avenue, and Homans Park is the park that the people on her block go to, a very small park and not very well kept, but kept up. But since they don't have any place to go, this is the place where families go. And when the crack economy started to decline in the late 1980s, the local street gang run by Big Cat started looking for new work. So they started to try and go into this park and recruit sex workers to come there. They started taxing all of the people who sold food and who made clothing and who fixed cars in the park. So they were trying to run an extortion racket. And this became a very difficult issue for Marlene, who started calling the police and saying, can you get the gangs out of our park? And the police didn't respond. And that's where she had to go into this mode of self-policing, I call, in the sense that she had to take the law into her own hands, if you will. And she started by telling Big Cat, okay, you know, you can use the park, but only, you know, you can't use it when the kids are there between 3 and 6 p.m. and in the mornings. That was an act of desperation. That didn't work. The gang, you know, overran and started using it at all times. So she called a pastor to mediate some of the discussions. The most fascinating thing for me was watching the residents at the block club meetings talk to each other about what exactly to do, because many of them actually recognized, you know, we can never fully get rid of the illegal economy. Do we compromise and work with a street gang leader? Do we put pressure on the police and protest and go to the community police meeting? Do we allow certain kinds of illegal activity to occur, maybe fixing cars but not others? So it raised a really difficult moral set of questions for folks in this particular block. And the pastor was useful in coming to help reduce some of the violence and some of the instability associated with the street gang. But, you know, they're still there to this day, so it's not a perfect situation.
Yeah, as you say, when good and bad become very relative terms, how do you solve your problems?
That's right. And it's a lot easier for me as a middle-class person to come and say, well, you know, and I did often. I would just call the police, or I would, you know, selling shoes or selling food is okay, but, you know, selling drugs is not. But, you know, some people just don't have those choices in poor communities to make. So as you're saying, morality is a very relative term, though in the abstract, folks do want what, in this poor community, the same as what I want, a clean neighborhood, a safe neighborhood, et cetera.
Yeah. So people are trying to do the right thing, and they struggle with that. But, you know, when push comes to shove, you got to go day to day here. How do people negotiate a desire for doing what's right and getting things done?
You know, when I was once asked by a student, where should I go to, a foreign student, where should I go to find America? And it's a tough question we all have to deal with. And I remember thinking of this neighborhood when I thought of that question. And I say that because at the core, there are fundamentally democratic principles of local governance in this community that are really beautiful to see. It's sad that they have to do it around drug dealing and street gang activity. But Marlene and the pastor and the residents, they came together, they discussed, they debated, they looked at their options, they tried to call the police, they elected a spokesperson, the pastor, to speak on their behalf. I mean, in some sense, this is what local governance is all about. It's not in my suburb of California, it's certainly not how we did it. We didn't have to deal with a street gang, and we had police to respond to, but in a way, these negotiations speak to a real fundamental American character of this community, and that, I think, is lost sometimes when we look at these neighborhoods and look at the negotiations. I think we have to remind ourselves that they want a moral life, they want a good life, a just life, and the way they're doing it is very similar to, you know, a place in Colorado or in Florida or many other parts of the country.
Is there a way out of the cycle? This can be, this, I mean, to live in this world, it's just got to be exhausting.
It's tremendously exhausting.
And it's dangerous.
And dangerous. And you know, part of the problem is that the deep set of skills that the pastor and that Marlene have accumulated in dealing with very difficult situations are not transferable, meaning that they can't put it on their resume that they solve street gang disputes and by virtue of that, you know, apply to the UN to be a diplomat. I mean, it just doesn't work that way. And the problem is that they don't have the connections to the outside world. They don't have a mechanism to be able to take what knowledge they have and skills that they've generated and to be able to catalyze them. So the person who fixes cars in the parking lot for $5, you know, that person perhaps if they had financial institutions that serve the community could get a small business loan and could work for an auto repair shop and then have his own auto repair shop one day. But because they don't have those kinds of institutions responding to them, they end up in this cycle of poverty.
Does it work the same way from poor neighborhood, city to city, the underground economy?
I think there are some notable differences. The first is that race is an important factor. One of the African Americans, more so than other groups, although other groups have also faced discrimination, African Americans have faced a tremendous amount of discrimination by social institutions in this country. So banks are not responding to them. Police do not cater to their neighborhoods in the same way. City government many times does not respond to their interests. And so they've had to make adjustments and adaptations. So the underground economy for them is an adaptation to neglect. Now, for many Latino communities, one could also find discrimination, but the kind of, and Asian communities, but the kind of credit associations that come up and the lending associations, the ways in which people hire family, those are often driven by the immigrant experience, not necessarily by hundreds of years of neglect and discrimination. So that's another example where in a poor working class community of Latino or Asian origin, you can see hiring and lending, et cetera, that occurs off the books, but not driven by the same set of circumstances.
Mm. How has middle-class flight affected the underground economy?
In several ways. One of the most important ways is that for the last 30 or 40 years, and middle-class, both black and white flight from some of these neighborhoods that are now predominantly poor in Chicago and in many other cities, it's the same situation, has resulted in a loss of demand. So as the resources that middle and upper class families have leaves, the businesses start to dry up, and only the businesses that serve poor people will stay, the currency exchanges, the dollar stores, the liquor stores, et cetera. The other way is that there's a loss of political capital. In almost every study you can read in sociology, if one actually reads sociology these days, is that middle class and upper class people have greater political capital. They can get things done in their neighborhood. As the flight of middle class families occurred, there was a less of a capacity of African Americans to make sure their streets were clean, their parks were clean, to make sure the police responded. So, not just economic capital, but political capital also recedes. And finally, it's not an area that's generally considered one for new investment. So it's not seen as attractive. It's not seen as a place that should attract new business growth, should attract new housing, et cetera. So the services and the condition of the neighborhood are often much more deteriorated as a result of that flight.
Mm. Sociologist Sudhir Aladi Venkatesh is our guest here this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's a sociologist. He's the author of Off the Books, The Underground Economy of the Urban Poor. Listeners, my name is Celeste Quinn, and I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions, comments. They're welcome. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL, and 333-WILL. What would people do in Mackay Park without their off-the-books earnings?
I think survival would just be that much more difficult. I mean, it's extraordinary to watch a family of two parents, two children, and what they can do with $20 or $25 in the off-the-books world. They can buy food, they can buy clothing, they can get their car fixed or maybe some plumbing fixed in their home in a way that they simply could not afford to do so in the legitimate economy. So at base, it's an economy of survival. But the other important thing to note is that it's not always a cash-driven economy. I met one, Leroy Patterson, who owned an auto shop, and he didn't have a cash register. He was so used to people not paying with cash, he just got rid of his cash register. So he was taking appliances and cell phones as payment or promises. And so people had these barter arrangements. So they know that if times are tough, even with a legitimate business, that they can pay in a different way, and not just with cash. And that's an important mechanism of exchange for poor people, promises and in-kind payment that lets them go on day to day.
What kind of income, cash payment, non-cash payment, can off-the-books earnings provide?
I mean, in terms of how much?
Yeah. I mean, how well can you do?
It's rarely, if ever, enough to support yourself. I'll give you some examples of people who are very successful. There's a woman in the book I talk about who sells lunches out of her home. She, all of the local city workers, the police, the neighbors come to her house every day at 11:30. They line up to buy prepared lunches. She also manages to convince the school to sell them to the teachers. She's a very entrepreneurial person, and she gets probably about $750 to $1,000 a month in a really good month. And she works very, very hard to do so. James, a mechanic, probably makes about $200 a month, $250 a month, changing oil and fixing cars on the street. They're not making a lot of money doing so, and as a result of which, you'll see in any household multiple family arrangements, so two or three familial units, a couple different mothers and their children, or fathers and mothers with their children living together, everyone taking care of rent and the bills. That's something you don't normally see. So a lot of people are working. It's just really just not enough to survive. It's just enough to get by, and then not much more.
It's a moth-eaten safety net.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk with a listener now, a caller waiting for us on line one, on a cell phone. Hello.
Hi. I have a question for Professor Venkatesh.
Go ahead.
What kind of schooling system was there in the neighborhood you described, and what was the kind of education these people were getting?
Generally, in this neighborhood, the school systems were deeply under-resourced in the sense that the amount of money they received from the Chicago Board of Education for books and the maintenance of the school was always insufficient relative to some of the middle-class neighborhoods. There was also a tremendously high dropout rate. I think at DuSable High School, Dunbar High School, is 40-45% of the students in the entering class. And that's a conservative figure. In ninth grade, don't graduate. So there's not a lot of faith in the school system. And at one point in time, before the underground economy was a real survival mechanism, those dropout rates were probably nearly as high. It's just that people would go into factories and into the industrial jobs that were available to them in the stockyards and the plants. Today, they don't have those options. So when they leave the school, they can't go into a union. They go right into the underground economy because that's all that's available, or the service sector, or they go back and forth. So the school systems are an important driving force in terms of not adequately preparing people to get the kind of jobs that you'd see that middle-class folk are able to get.
Just to follow on the things you told, the spokesperson of the group or the community, did they have, you know, any sense of how important education would be, and did they have any stress? Did they stress it in the community, or did they do any checks to improve education?
Just as an example, the person Marlene that I was talking about, the Block Club president and the pastor, both along with other community leaders, are constantly involved in education. I would say, after crime and safety, it's the next big issue for them, as it is for many American families. And they're protesting lack of school funding. They're constantly making sure that kids on their block are going to school. They're trying to get philanthropic attention for after-school programs, but many leaders in poor communities don't have the connections to the Ford Foundation and the big philanthropies, the United Ways, to be able to leverage that kind of support. So it's a lack of a connection sometimes to the outside world that can actually help them do some things that they're doing in very informal ways.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the questions. Next, we talk with another listener on a cell phone, line 2. Hi.
Hi, how are you? If not the one of the underlayments of your study or book here, is that there is systemic discrimination in this country, racism, and it's systemic. I mean, you mentioned the lady who in this neighborhood really was trying to get the gangs out of there and called the police, and they didn't respond. Is that not systemic, and is that not racist?
I think that there are all sorts of ways. The kind of racism you're talking about is a very important one to take note of.
It's institutional.
Yeah, and it can take a number of forms. So in some ways, the lack of a police response, that you can count, you know, the times for ambulance personnel and police to respond by different neighborhood of different class and ethnic makeup, you can document, as social scientists have done, that kind of racism and discrimination. It occurs in other ways, though, that we often don't see, which is equally as pernicious. For example, a lot of these small businesses were asked to come to a bank that offered that wanted to respond to the city's need to give small business loans to the community. So this bank came into this very poor community and said, you know, we'd like to be responsive to you, the business persons. The people stood up in the audience and said, well, we want, you know, $50. We have to pay our light bill, or can we get $150? We just need to buy some paper or something like that. And the bank said, well, we can give you $10,000 or $25 or $50, but, you know, we don't normally lend $100 or $500. And so, you know, I wouldn't call that racism, but what I would say is that there's a deep failure to connect between the institutions that could provide them services and the people themselves. So many institutions just simply don't know how to communicate and don't have an understanding of what it means to be an economic actor, an entrepreneur in these communities. And by virtue of them not being understanding what it means to act economically, they don't respond. And so it looks as though, on the face of it, that banks are just not responsive, which is true, but the mechanisms by which they're not responsive are also important to document, just as your example is as well.
Well, my point is, though, that it perpetuates this kind of a situation, and then we as a people conclude that all blacks are in those neighborhoods don't want to be any better than to have this underground world. I think that's not true. That's a fallacy.
I think that's exactly right. This is a world born out of desperation. It's a world
Absolutely.
Born out of discrimination from the wider world. And the other big stereotype, in addition to what you're saying, is that we tend to assume that when people are living in unemployed neighborhoods or neighborhoods of high unemployment, that they don't want to work and they don't have skills. And that is probably the farthest from the truth. They're extraordinarily skilled people who can do the same jobs as anyone else if given the opportunity.
I agree with you, and thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. What are here's a consequence we have for this situation. For in terms of the middle class worldview, here is quite impoverished when we look at this. We only look at the surface here. What are some of the other? Are there other consequences for the larger community, a larger city, the country?
Yeah, I think there are a number of other consequences, and on different levels. First is that the more that these conditions are allowed to persist, the more you will have communities that are alienated and by virtue of having to depend on an underground economy from the larger society. Without getting banks and to be responsive, police to be responsive, et cetera, you risk creating situations of profound alienation. And what happens is that you end up looking at these moments of crisis, like, unfortunately, Hurricane Katrina, to be able to see when these communities, to be able to see these communities. Those are the moments in which these places are rendered visible. And then you see the extent to which people are living in very desperate situations. The other is that we're really not capitalizing on a very important resource that exists, a very important community with an enormous amount of skills and labor that exists in our very backyards. Businesses are always looking for places to invest, and we've not really looked to inner cities for this particular kind of investment. We've certainly had very powerful initiatives like the Empowerment Zone that was developed in the Clinton era. Urban renewal still continues to go on in many neighborhoods, and gentrification. But those aren't necessarily initiatives that seek to bring up the social and political capital of the people who are living in those areas. And to do that, we really have to change our perspective and not see them as either lazy or indigent or unskilled, but as needing to have the kinds of connections that people in the wider world do. And, as our world becomes more global and as our world becomes interconnected to areas far, far away, these places just keep falling further and further behind, and the challenge just grows greater and greater.
Hmm. Do the gangs present a problem, a barrier in terms of breaking the cycle of the underground economy?
I think so, and I think the barrier gets more difficult at certain times. In the late 80s and the early 1990s, when the crack cocaine trade really overtook a lot of the Midwestern cities, from down to St. Louis to north to Milwaukee to Cleveland and over to New York, where I'm at, a lot of these communities were ravaged by a crack cocaine epidemic, and the street gangs really prospered, and it became very difficult to live in those kinds of areas. That's a particular kind of problem with a street gang when they become these huge businesses. Today, in fact, we have a different kind of problem in many of these neighborhoods, which is that the gangs aren't so organized, but they exist in these balkanized, separate communities, and they're fighting each other. So, ironically, as many criminologists often show, when you have less connected, less business-like street gangs, you actually have more street gang violence, higher rates of street gang homicide. So it's a funny situation in which, you can have something like a street gang, and it can pose a completely different kind of problem depending on what that street gang is actually doing.
How did people in the neighborhood see the gang you call the Black Kings?
I think on the whole, it was probably a little bit of fear and apprehension. It's still very difficult for me, and I've spent a decade with these folks, to really get a sense of the tremendous difficulty of the decision to work with a street gang to solve a problem that the gang is doing. I mean, I'm socialized to call the police or to call the social worker to be able to rely on institutions. A street gang comes into a park, and one of these block club presidents has to figure out, okay, how do I get this street gang to stop dealing drugs? Well, they're not going to, so what choices do I have? These are armed folks who can be extremely violent and who can be extremely abusive. And for that person, that woman, to go and confront them is a very difficult choice, but she really, in fact, has no choice. And so it's a very complex world that she has to deal with, and a very complicated diplomatic water that she's moving in. And it was really an incredible sight to see how she had to protect the interests of her community, while at the same time trying to get the police to respond and the city to clean up the park, etc.
How did Big Cat, the leader of the Black Kings, how did he talk about himself? This is really interesting.
He was a really he really saw himself as what he would call a community man. He would use different words for it, but often he would say, you know, I think about myself as a community man. But what he meant by that was that he saw himself as a kind of quasi-philanthropist, someone who was actually trying to do good on behalf of the community, someone who wanted to be accepted as part of the community. And it was, you know, and it is, if you know, my reaction just continues to be, it's very perverse that someone who's trafficking in narcotics, someone who's dealing drugs in the community, who think about themselves like that. But what he was very attentive to is history. And the history that he was attentive to, and it's one version, is that in the 20s and 30s and 40s, and 1920s, 30s and 40s, in the same community, you had the hustlers, you had the ward bosses, etc., who were doing illegal activities, whether it was bootlegging or running numbers and various kinds of gambling rackets. And his relatives actually were some of the largest and powerful ward bosses in Chicago. And he wanted to always emulate them. He wanted to be someone who could make things happen in the community by virtue of either the wealth that they controlled or the fact that they control public activity and who can go where at what times. It's a much different situation when we're talking about somebody who can, is controlling a gambling racket in the 20s or dealing alcohol than a street gang leader. But it's important to recognize that's what his model was. That's what was driving him. For many of the residents who were older than him, they could, you know, often just shook their head and hope that he actually never ascended to that position. But they understood where it was coming from. They understood his thirst for power, because it was part of the thirst for power in those communities for many decades.
Mm. How does the head of a gang, how does somebody like a Big Cat stay on top?
Through two different sets of skills. One, as you can imagine, just being ruthless and being able to use violence when necessary. Big Cat managed to extort nearly all the stores in a few little section of a commercial strip in that area. He at one point could go into almost any park and start trafficking drugs because he forced residents to allow him there. But on the other hand, he also had to be very, very smart about how he was doing. He was not an unintelligent person, no matter, you know, I certainly don't condone his behavior, but you can't say that he was not, because of the skill that he had to use to manage several hundred people in this economy. He would, you know, do what I thought was just quite outlandish stuff. Like he would threaten owners with extortion, keep sending his lieutenants to going to their stores and saying, you know, we're going to come for payment, but he would actually never come for the payment, just to sow the seeds of fear. And he did that in certain places because he knew those store owners would call the police. But, you know, as long as they never actually extorted them and just kept threatening them, he thought that the gang would not be prosecuted, which was false. But he would often use these kinds of tactics to pit people against one another. Anyone was a resource. You know, a homeless person, he would pay $25 a week to just stand on the corner and watch out for police, knowing that the homeless person needed money. So anyone in the community could be brought into his lair.
Yeah. So on the one hand, he's a thug, but on the other hand, you could also say he's not unlike a CEO, he's not unlike a preacher, he's not unlike a politician.
That's right. The CEO analogy, I think, is an important one. Together with an economist, Stephen Levitt, at the University of Chicago, I conducted some research, part of which is in this book, that showed that the street gang functions as a kind of a corporation. When they're running their business, you know, you can run a business in many different ways. You can run a business as a family business. The street gangs chose to run it modeled after a franchise, so that all of the neighborhoods had a hierarchical line of authority. You had a director, and then, you know, lieutenants, and then the rank and file, and those neighborhoods were connected to one another, and There was somebody overseeing various neighborhood groups, and it looked almost like a McDonald's franchise. And you know, if you were good, you got promoted to different levels, and you had you could make certain wages depending on what level you were at. So he was really a consummate businessman in that world, and he looked to that structure as I mean, he wanted to emulate a corporate mentality.
Yeah, and there's actually a code you write about. A book that he was very important to him, Literature of Black Kings Nation. It's a guide of sorts.
That's right. This was most of the street gangs in Chicago arose in their present form out of the late 60s and early 70s when African American youth were jailed after the civil rights era. And in going to jail, they formed coalitions and formed alliances, which became the basis of our modern street gangs. And in jail, they created all of these oaths and all these codes of conduct. And that is seen as a literature that informs the practices of many contemporary gangs. And it gives them a history of where they came from. And it's just in the same way that Big Cat saw himself as a local philanthropist or somebody who wanted to help the community. You know, he might give Marlene $500, in a given month for a back-to-school party for children, just as he said his great-uncle would do or his uncle would do, who was a ward boss. He looked to this book to give him guidance, and in this book there was a lot of talk about how the street gang is part of the community, the street gang is responsive to the needs of poor black people. And we have to remember this was in the civil rights era and the post-civil rights era, in which African-American youth were far less entrepreneurial in terms of street gang, and far more driven by militant political ideology. And that's really what that book served for Big Cat.
Mm. From time to time, you were called on to mediate when a problem cropped up. What was your experience like as a mediator?
This is actually how the entire project came into being. I was doing research for an entirely different book on public housing, and as I was hanging out in these neighborhoods, there would be a car mechanic who got a fight with or a dispute with a customer, and they couldn't find a third party. And I would be standing nearby, and they'd say, "Can you mediate this dispute?" And I'd throw out some kind of resolution, not knowing anything about what I was doing. And people sort of started thinking of me as disinterested, that I was a fair and neutral observer. And it was really watching, it was really participating in that very small way. And, you know, another example might be a store owner and the homeless person that he hires, and they get into an argument, I might just mediate that. That I started seeing this very complex, rich set of negotiations in this underground economy that existed. I tried to limit it as much as I could. For example, I told some of the managers of the prostitutes, the pimps, that I couldn't work with them. I told the car thieves that I couldn't arbitrate their disputes. You know, for a car mechanic, it's one thing, I thought, but for pimps, it's another. But, you know, they laughed and they said, well, you know, we're hustling too, and we have our, you know, your middle-class distinctions, they told me, don't hold. So it was a peculiar situation in which I had to kind of tell them, well, even if my distinctions don't hold, I'm not necessarily going to go and, you know, help you guys figure out how to deal with your sex workers. So it got me into some funny situations, and in time I was able to just completely say no to everything, but once in a while, just so things didn't get out of hand and drawn into something.
Yeah. And this role made you a little uncomfortable as a sociologist as well. How did you think through that problem?
That was a difficult decision because you really do want to try to be objective, and you don't want to try and not have an influence on the object that you're studying. You don't want to contaminate it in some ways, if we want to use that metaphor. But the other important, by virtue of having seen that they saw me as a neutral third party, it actually opened up a world to me that I wouldn't have seen otherwise. And so it was a compromise worth making initially, just in the sense that it allowed me into places and to people's lives, and to see that there's a very important role for these kinds of arbiters. If I didn't go through that experience, you know, I could have just handed out a survey, asked people what they made and how much they earn and what they spend it on, and perhaps never saw this rich side of the legal side of the underground economy.
Yeah, and you might not have gotten very good answers either. I mean, reliable answers.
Right.
What's the neighborhood like today? When at the end of the book, it's 2000, 6 years later, what's the place like today?
If one were to drive on the south side of the the Chicago today. It's changing minute by minute, really. One of the most important changes is that something like 20,000 public housing units have been are being taken away from the city. So all of the large high-rise so-called projects that were there have been almost all of them have been torn down, and that's led to a real outflow of poor families to the outlying suburbs and to the edge neighborhoods. In its place, another important transformation is the gentrification of these neighborhoods. So in the communities that I studied, which were extremely poor, you'll start to see cropping up condominiums for $200,000 and coffee shops and cafes and nightclubs in places that, you know, as early as 2000, really never you couldn't imagine anything like that coming up. So there's a tremendous, there's a real revitalization of interest in these neighborhoods economically and in terms of real estate development today.
And the people who are being pushed out, what's their situation? Is it, has it improved?
Many of the people that in the neighborhoods have relocated to the south side, the outlying suburbs like Dalton and Harvey, just at the edge of Chicago, or right at the edge of Chicago, Roseland and West Pullman, that were once industrial working class areas. I can't say that their situation has improved measurably because they're still not really located close to any areas of job growth. There's not a lot of services. Those communities are just not able to handle this influx of new poor people coming there. And it's created, as you can imagine, a new set of tensions between different classes of African-Americans living next to each other.
Mm. There we have to leave it. Thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. Really a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you.
Sudhir Aladi Venkatesh is professor of sociology and director of research at the Institute for Research in African American Studies at Columbia University. He is the author of Off the Books, The Underground Economy of the Urban Poor. It is published by Harvard University Press. And that interview from the archives, we talked with Professor Venkatesh in October of 2006, on October 27th, 2006. 1:53 Central Time. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade and from Kansas City as well. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. A little follow-through buying in today's trade after yesterday's move upward at the Chicago Board of Trade and Kansas City futures. They followed through as well, up 3.25 cents in the nearby May contract at 486.75. The July futures, that's the harvest month for the hard red winter wheat, at $4.89.25. It, of course, is traded in Kansas City, up 2 cents for the day. From Chicago, where the soft red winter wheat is traded, May futures had a high today of 469.75, a low at $4.60. Settlement price at 462.75, up 2.75. July 482.75 on the high, the low at 73.5. The settlement price at 476.25. They were up 2.5 for the day. And the September futures, 493, the high, the low at 485.5. A settlement price at $4.86.5, up 2.5 cents. December contract of 504.25 top, low at $4.96.5. And December soft red winter wheat in Chicago settled just a penny below $5 at $4.99. They were up 3.5 cents on the day. March wheat at 512 on the high, the low at 505. The March 2008 futures contract at 508 on the settlement price, up 2.5 cents for the day. From Chicago's corn pit now.